school and religion, and that that's the core of it.
That's right, and that gets you when you're young enough not to even know what's happening to you.
We've come to the end of this conversation. It is something that will continue, if you're interested, by going to patreon.com/economicupdate, where we'll keep the conversation going. Otherwise, I look forward to talking with you again next week.
Have you wondered what volunteering at KBOO is like? Do you want to get more involved with your community radio station? KBOO's fall membership drive begins Thursday, September 6th, and runs through Saturday, September 22nd. We need volunteers to answer the phone lines throughout the drive. You can make a huge difference with your participation, helping listeners become members. It's a great way to support KBOO while getting a behind-the-scenes view of how we work at our busiest time. Email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 213, to find shifts that work for your schedule. Thank you for supporting KBOO Portland.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Fritjof Capra. Fritjof is a theoretical physicist and systems theorist, author of several international best-selling books, including The Tao of Physics, The Web of Life, and Hidden Connections. His most recent book is The Systems View of Life, co-authored with Pierre Luigi Luisi. Welcome to Madness Radio, Fritjof Capra.
Well, it's a great pleasure, Will, to be on your show, and I look forward to our conversation.
Now, I think a lot of our listeners may be familiar with your classic book from 1975, Tao of Physics, and for many, many years, you have been a leading light in trying to get at some of the philosophical and scientific thinking underpinning of what is the broader human crisis that we're in. And so I am very grateful for your work and for your books, and it's an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And let's see, so, you know, I think it's very interesting. You have a journey from a theoretical physicist to someone who got interested in Eastern philosophy and Eastern spirituality and the connections between the two. And now you have written this book, The Systems View of Life, which is really a textbook about a kind of a deeper, holistic, ecological revision of the sciences and how we think about the world and ourselves and knowledge, which has huge implications for mental health and healthcare. How did you kind of make that journey from a theoretical physicist to begin with?
You know, my childhood does have an influence because, for one thing, I grew up on a farm. I spent the first 10 years of my life on a farm in southern Austria. And this was during and just after World War II. So the farm was totally self-sufficient. The economy of the country had broken down after the war. And so there was not much you could buy in shops. So we had our own vegetables, we had our fruits, we had our pigs for sausages, we had our cows, goat, chickens, and so on. And, you know, we baked our bread and we pressed oil and cider. So it was a completely self-sufficient and, as you would now say, sustainable system. And it was a large community because it belonged to my grandmother and then my aunt. And so various members of my extended family came to live on the farm because, you know, we sought shelter on this farm, which was sort of an oasis amidst the war and post-war trauma. And there were a lot of refugees seeking shelter on the farm. So what I'm saying is that my sense of ecology, being out in nature on a farm for the first 10 years of my life, and the sense of community, which is also very important for sustainability, that was really nurtured in my early childhood.
Yeah. That's really remarkable. Also, the contrast between that sort of very positive, idealistic vision of how people can live together and take care of each other in a sustainable way in the context of this catastrophe that has happened in the surround. And that's kind of like an imprint of your work in general, it seems.
Yes, yes. I came to realize this, you know, long after I wrote my books.
Wow.
Just very recently.
So you mentioned the mechanistic worldview. What is a mechanistic view, and what is it that's so negative or dangerous or limiting about this mechanistic view?
The mechanistic worldview was a huge success for about 300 years, from the 17th to the 20th century. Mechanistic model, although it was successful in astronomy and in a lot of branches of physics, it can only be taken so far. And for instance, in medicine, mechanistic medicine says, you know, if you are sick, then it's, Descartes actually said that himself, a sick body is like a malfunctioning clock. And what you have to do to fix it is to find the part that is not functioning. And either you take it out with surgery, or you fix it chemically or with some other means, and then the clock will function again. Well, this applies only in a very, very limited way, because my health is not the sum of the health of my parts, but derives from the processes and relationships involving those parts. So there's a shift from the parts to the whole, from objects to relationships, from gene to the network. That's essentially the paradigm shift from the mechanistic to the holistic or systemic view.
And the idea that the part is broken seeks the problem within the machine, rather than seeing this person as part of a context and being part of systems within systems within systems, which may actually be responding and reacting to and relating to things outside of something inside of it. I mean, we clearly see this as a fallacy in mental health care and psychiatry. We often talk about the medical model, and we have to go beyond the medical model. Well, maybe there's nothing wrong with medicine. Maybe the problem is that there's a mechanistic view of the mind and a mechanistic view of emotions and a mechanistic view that we can just fix it with pills, or there must be something broken inside of you that we're going to go in and adjust working on a machine.
The key error of this biomedical model of medicine, in my view, is the confusion between the origin of an illness and the manifestation in various malfunctioning processes. So they take the malfunctioning processes as the cause and say, you know, you are sick because, you know, a part of your stomach doesn't function well, so we'll give you some drugs to make it function again. But there's a reason why the parts of the stomach don't function well. The reason may be that you are under tremendous emotional stress. And so, you know, the gut has certain, you know, parts that respond to stress, as we all know. And so if you just fix that and the stress persists, well, then the illness may just express itself in another way, not in the stomach, but maybe in the heart or in the brain or in other parts.
And so let's think about the implications of this in terms of healthcare or mental health care, because immediately what comes to me is that, you know, an individual may come to me for help and they may say, you know, I've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Can you help me figure out, you know, what medication or medications are working for me, help me figure out what's kind of inside of my head that needs to be fixed. And what I will do instead is help there be a shift to just stepping back from seeing it within that individual head and start to discuss about the entire context and the whole living reality that the person is in, which is about their relationships, it's about their work, it's about the place that they live, it's about their relationship to nature, it can be about their nutrition, all the different things. So there's some very, very radical shift, and it seems to me that, you know, maybe other areas of science and other areas of society are moving in this direction of this paradigm shift away from a mechanistic view. But unfortunately, psychiatry is maybe lagging behind in some ways.
Yeah. Well, let me talk a little more about health. And first of all, this Santiago view of cognition as the process of life solves a puzzle that has plagued scientists and philosophers for centuries, the puzzle which I've mentioned already. What is the relationship exactly between the mind and the brain? You know, it has been known for a long time that mental activity involves the brain, but what is the exact relationship? And even in textbooks as recently as maybe 20 years ago or 10 years ago, you know, the authors of these textbooks on neuroscience didn't have a clue about what the relationship is between mind and brain. Well, in the Santiago theory, this relationship is very clear and very simple. Mind or cognition is the process of life, and the brain is a particular structure within which this process takes place. The brain is not the only structure, but it is, in higher organisms, a very important structure. So the relationship between mind and brain is a relationship between process and structure. And in all living systems, you always have to deal with both process and structure, because As I mentioned before, living structure is always changing, always moving, always evolving. There is no such thing as a static living structure. And the process of life, of course, cannot take place in a vacuum. It needs matter, it needs biology to express itself. So process and structure are sort of two sides of the same coin of life. And therefore, coming now to health, every process that plays a role in health is associated with a certain structure. And conversely, every structure that plays a role is associated with a certain process or certain processes. So when we now speak about psychosomatic, about mind-body interaction, psyche and soma, we have to say that the process of getting sick and the process of healing has both physical aspects, bodily aspects, and mental aspects. So there's no such thing as a psychosomatic illness. All illness is psychosomatic. All healing is psychosomatic. So again, that's a tremendous shift, the tremendous expansion of this whole notion of psychosomatic.
And this is really crucial, what you said, that there is no clear scientific explanation that has given some kind of theory or discovery about how the mind arises from the brain. That is a puzzle that has not been solved. And yet, an entire field of mental health treatments emerges that says, well, okay, we haven't solved this, but we're just going to set it aside and we're going to assume that all the problems of the mind, which may be emotions or stress or, you know, whatever psychiatric diagnosis or whatever struggle that people are having on an emotional psychological level is having at the level of mind, we're going to just set that problem aside and then assume that we can just focus on the brain. Yeah. And what you're saying, that's completely misconceived, that actually that brain is just one structure in a whole network of structures that is involved in this ongoing process, and the process itself and all the structures, the body, the nervous system, the food system, all the context, the social context that the person lives in, all of that is going to be part of anything that involves mind.
And we know, for example, you know, if there's an event, a dramatic event in my family, or if you have a death in the family, or you have a dramatic, traumatic event, I get sick in my stomach. And the stomach is not the brain, but it's still a structure which is involved in this psychosomatic relationship. And the entire organism is always involved. And what you said before, Will, made me think that, you know, an unfortunate legacy of the mechanistic worldview is the refusal of scientists to ask fundamental questions. Like, for instance, in biology, when you study biology, you can get through your whole university study, undergraduate and graduate, and you never hear a teacher ask the question, what is life? Although you might think biology is the science of life, so that should be asked in the first class in your undergraduate years. Similarly, you know, nobody in medical school asks what is health or what is mental health. And this is the same in every field, you know. The fundamental questions are not asked. Well, the system theory of life does ask these fundamental questions.
Do you think that it's kind of inevitable that we are shifting towards a more systems view, or do you think that it is taking more activism and more intentional pushing kind of from change agents? In other words, is it a sort of like a general cultural shift that's part of an evolutionary process, or do you think that it might be something else going on?
No, I think it's an evolutionary process, and it would not need any change agents if the consequences of the mechanistic view were not so severe. I mean, you know, all these problems we have, just think of fossil fuels, you know, climate change caused by excessive use of fossil fuels. I mean, the fossil fuel companies spend millions and billions of dollars to confuse people, to promote the idea that climate change is not real, to hide the problems, just to continue as long as possible with their profits. They all know that it's going to end, but they just want to push it as much as possible, which causes tremendous harm. The same with economic inequality. No, the shift of money from the poor to the rich, which is now the sort of, you know, national economic theory in many countries, causes tremendous harm. Now, these are all consequences of seeing the world in a fragmented way, in a separate way. And we do need activism to fight that. We do need to promote the systems view of life.
Yeah, your discussion of this makes me think of just the systems view of activism and political change, because there are so many different individual issues that people are interested in and involved in. And then we can think about what the issues of the future are going to be, especially given all the technological change. But I think that's kind of like a downstream way of viewing, and it doesn't have enough of a systems or upstream approach, which would say, well, why is it that our democratic governance has broken down? Why is it that the votes and the opinions and the views of ordinary people aren't having any kind of counterbalancing effect against industry and unregulated profit and growth and the way in which the whole system is not responsive to human needs? And I think that points us in the direction of seeing the systems change that needs to happen in the way that we make decisions as a society, so that it's not about money buying votes, but it's about each of us having our vote, which movements, the labor movement, the women's movement, the abolition of slavery movement, I mean, the civil rights movement, I mean, all these movements have been working for giving us a real meaningful thing, which is the right to vote about our destiny as a nation. And now that's just been completely replaced, or almost completely replaced, by money buying votes. And so I think that would be a really valuable direction for a systems view of political change, that we can get into the rules of the game. Because you mentioned the fossil fuel industry. Well, the CEO and the board of director of all those fossil fuel companies, they're bound by law to make as much profit as possible. They have to maximize their fiscal return. That's in the law that binds those articles of incorporation for those companies. And so if we want to really affect things, it's even deeper than saying pharma or the fossil fuel industry or agribusiness. It's something like about the rules of the game. The system that's been set up for these different industries to operate needs to be looked at, because it's all interconnected. It's not separate issues. It's all these interconnected things that have these relationships between them.
Within the global civil society, this global coalition of NGOs, of change activists, systems thinking is very common. So many of the leaders of this global movement, people like Lester Brown, Hazel Henderson, Amory Lovins, Naomi Klein, Vandana Shiva, and so on. These are just a few of the real leaders of this global civil society. They're all systemic thinkers. And so this is very good news. I would say when you look at the various strata of society or at the various fields, I would say systems thinking is practiced most in the global civil society, in these activists, in these NGOs. Secondly, I would say in some academic circles, not in all by any means, but in some. Thirdly, I would say in business. Again, there are some, you know, advanced companies who practice systemic management, new types of organizations, shift from hierarchies to networks, self-organizing teams, and so on. And last, by politicians. So politicians are the last to really get a handle of systems thinking.
So your first book, The Tao of Physics, really was bringing the spirituality in. So tell us a little bit more about how spirituality fits into the systems view of life and systems thinking that we're talking about.
It's very important to distinguish between spirituality and religion. Spirituality is a certain perception of reality that is independent of cultural and historical contexts. You have spiritual people in India, in China, in Africa, in Latin America, in Europe, in the US, in Canada, and spiritual experience as an experience of wholeness, of belonging to a larger whole, of being embedded in a larger whole, of transcending the mind-body difference, and so on. This kind of experience is a universal experience that is independent of cultural and historical contexts. Then religion is the attempt to explain the experience and make it the basis of the structure of a religious community, of a system of ethics or morals that are guidelines for this community. And when that happens, and it happens everywhere, religion becomes dependent on historical and cultural context. So the same type of spiritual experience of, say, a Teresa of Avila or Saint John of the Cross in Christianity, and of a Mahatma Gandhi or a spiritual teacher in the East or in Latin America, the same type of experience is interpreted in different ways. And what happened, especially in Christianity, was that the interpretation was confused with the reality of the experience and was presented as dogma.
And would you say that the heart of that spiritual experience is kind of a deep intuition of this system's view of life?
It's not just a deep intuition, it's an actual experience of aliveness. I come back to metabolism being metaphorically called the breath of life. So if you experience the breath of life, in a very intense way in what Maslow called peak experiences. That is a spiritual experience. So you can have this experience in meditation, you can have this experience in a sexual encounter, you can have it in sports. I personally have had such experiences while skiing in the mountains of Austria in my youth. You can have it in art, in listening to a piece of music, or in a dance performance, or any kind of art. So it's a feeling of intense aliveness. And during this experience of intense aliveness, you transcend the boundary of the self and you somehow fuse with the environment around you. And so, for example, when we talk about ecology, ecology is the science of connectedness, of relationships, relationships between members of the earth household, oikos, which is the linguistic root of the word ecology. So when you learn that everything is related in nature, that you have communities of life that are embedded in non-living matter and dependent on non-living matter, then this relates very strongly to an actual experience which you might have when you meditate, you know, in a forest or on a beach, and suddenly you feel connected to the whole environment and you experience the whole environment as being intensely alive. So we see, you know, the systems view of life is, again, the theoretical interpretation as compared to the actual living experience.
Fritjof, we don't have enough time, but give people again the name of your new book and how they can get in touch with you.
The book is The Systems View of Life, co-authored by Pierluigi Luisi and myself. My personal website is my name, fritjofcapra.net, and the website of the Capra course, the online course, is capracourse.net.
Fritjof Capra, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Well, thank you. That was very inspiring and wonderful.
You've been listening to an interview with Fritjof Capra. Fritjof is a theoretical physicist and systems theorist, author of several international best-selling books, including The Tao of Physics, The Web of Life, and Hidden Connections. His most recent book is The Systems View of Life, co-authored with Pierluigi Luisi. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio host is Will Hall, producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio is an affiliate of Madden America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at maddenamerica.com.
In 1967, Bob Dylan and several members of what became The Band got together in upstate New York. For months, they played and recorded. Join Rita Houston as she talks to band members about that time and samples some of the musical gems that are in the complete basement tapes. All right here on the Singer-Songwriter edition of the Monday Sampler, September 3rd at 2 p.m. Are we gonna sit down in the
pizza chair? KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society's new concert season, which starts September 21st of this year and runs through May of 2019, all staged at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. The Portland Folk Music Society is pleased to present a lineup of national and regional artists, including Molly O'Brien and Rich Moore, the Kathy Kallick Band, the Honey Whiskey Trio, Legends of the Celtic Harp with Patrick Ball, True North, Tish Hinojosa, Pat Donahue, Nina Gerber and Chris Webster, and Dave Stamey. And for the first time, the Portland Folk Music Society is offering season ticket packages at prices below single show rates, either online or at the door. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and look on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And it's 11:59. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. It's time now for the Noontime Jamboree. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit and Amy Mann, Friday, September 7th. All ages welcome. Tickets and more information available online at zooconcerts.com.
Everything is peaches, neat the old apple tree. Peaches for me and my gal. We're a perfect pair beneath the old apple tree. How I love her, how she loves me. Robin Redbreast up above thinks that we're okay. For he sings his song of love all the livelong day. Everything is peaches, neat the old apple tree. Peaches for me and my gal.